are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
Our guest on today's show is Claire Parsons, chair and co-founder of Lansons, a leading reputation management and PR business based in London and New York. Claire has been actively involved both in the PR industry and the not-for-profit sector. She is on the global board of PROI Worldwide. She was the global chair from 2018 to 2020, the first woman to hold this role in its 50-year history. She has served on various charity boards, committees, and on trade bodies. Currently, she is an advisory board member for Every Woman, a trustee of arts charity High Tide, and patron of Juvenile Diabetes Research Charity. Claire was recognized with the Stephen Talent Award by the CIPR for her contribution to the PR industry, where she's also a fellow. Welcome to the show, Claire. It's a pleasure having you here. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you got into PR.
Well, I think everybody's got their own story, haven't they, of how things come about. Well, when I graduated, I had to decide on the direction of my travel because I loved theatre and I was contemplating going into theatre administration, and I loved that. And I decided that that was going to be my passion rather than my job. And I moved then into what type of work was I going to do. Well, I found a job in Cheapside working for an insurance company that was 150 years old, who had sponsored a play called Happy Birthday, and they were taking it around the UK. So I joined their marketing department and looked after that production going around the UK. I was interviewed, as often in those days, in a wine bar. and they asked me what my experience of finance was, because it was a financial company. My mother was widowed when I was six and my sister was two. And as a consequence, suddenly she owned the property she was in, but she had to work. So we weren't from a wealthy background. And so my early experience was somebody who recognized the value of having surety and security around them. But I think part of that means that I am definitely a product of a strong working woman. And we often reflect quite a lot of our own family behaviors. And that put me into being in marketing.
That's fascinating. And I love what you've said about, you know, what's going to be your passion and what's going to be the area that you work in. So how did you come to set up Lansons?
I think, again, part of I've always believed in playing to your strengths. And I was always taught you can find people to work on your weaknesses, but always go and trust your instincts and play to your strengths. So I had found myself, or actually I chose to go into a consultancy called Hugh Rogerson. And back then they were doing integrated communications and we were doing a lot of privatization. So big ticket stuff. And it was very exciting. And I wanted to see whether I could do it without the big brand behind me. I worked for a major company on big companies, and I wanted to see whether my love of what I was doing, but also my ability, was within myself or within them. So I joined a startup. That startup was very swiftly bought by another. And my clients at the time, this was the 80s, and that period was a lot of people were being made millionaires when their businesses were sold, whether they were estate agents, whether they're in small insurance businesses. Anyway, I worked for a number of those and they came to me and said that they would back me if I started a business. I spoke to my then partner because we'd been discussing this a little bit. And we agreed that we didn't want to have their money because it came with all sorts of conditions, but that we would do it ourselves. And so I started with the notion of some credit cards, remortgaging our flat. And the person I was talking to at that time, I was going out with, he became my business partner and then my husband, which is Tony Langham. So we remortgaged, had credit cards. I hadn't realized how fortunate we were to have those businesses talking to us about coming with their business. And they were very gracious, having turned down their offer. They still came to us. And we started Lansons then. I mean, obviously living on baked beans for quite a while. But it was a different time. It really was. I mean, the bank wouldn't open an account for me because they didn't believe me. So I had to have my first month, or in fact, we were quarterly in advance in our fees. I came in with a series of checks in those days to open the bank account. And they were forced into it rather than actually believed in us when we said we wanted to launch. But I think it was a different time back then. We started in a merchant bank. I spoke to the client and said I would give them a discounted rate if we could work from their office. And that was the start of Lansons.
Wow, absolutely fascinating journey. And what would you say, Claire, was your organizational purpose when you set it up? I can see that you, you know, from the story you've said is that you were testing out and you went into where a lot of people didn't go at that time because you believed in what you were doing.
You've got to believe in yourself, haven't you? And I do believe, and I've always believed, and so does Tony, that we have a responsibility. We're lucky enough to have jobs. We're lucky enough to be able to be in a position of power even then. And we set up wanting to be a fair and meritocratic business with no glass ceilings. I'd already, as a woman, found myself with barriers that I didn't feel comfortable with. So I wanted to have no expectation that privilege would give you better rewards. We were state educated. We believed in hard work. And even our first press release typed out on a typewriter back then talked about those things of fairness. And then because we believed in being a partnership at that time, clearly it was only Tony and I and then a temporary person, we quickly worked out that we did have a little business going and we set up a partnership. And that partnership was an intent to invite people to join us in this journey. And today, a third of our people are partners. We're 85 people in total. A third of our people have a partnership with us. And back then, we went to a legal company and they gave us a first draft and I rejected it. I rejected it because all the way through, the language of the law was he. And in those days, I refused it, so it became she. So our partnership agreement is in the feminine to make a point rather than necessarily anything to do with sexuality today. Yeah. And in there was 1% of our profits were going to charity. And even in the first year, it was only £250, but we gave £250 to a charity. And ever since, for 31 years, it has been an important part of our perspective in the world that we contribute to it, and it is enshrined in our partnership agreement. And that for us has greater importance. It's not just a symbol, it is part of our ethos.
So, you know, when you started off, you started with purpose and you're continuing to live with that intent with which you started. And of course, it's grown. Lansons is one of the most respected agencies today.
We do know, by the way, that this is why we don't talk about it that much as well. We recognize there are holes in everything. There are gaps in everything. But we do have a purpose and an intent. And we try hard to live that. Not always wholly successfully, but we do try hard to.
I think that's the best one can do is try your best and be fair in how you do it. Fair and transparent. In a post-fake news COVID BLM world, purpose has become a buzzword for organizations and comms professionals. As somebody who heads an agency, you must have seen in the last 6 months where organizations are trying to retrofit purpose into their mission and vision statement. Do you think it is opportunistic or here to stay? And what does it actually mean to be a purpose-driven organization?
There's a lot in this, isn't there? And we're still all working it through. And I think it's an exciting time to be in the work we're doing. I do think it's here to stay, and it's here to stay because society now is forcing change on business and the world. It believes now it has a voice, and it, and society and stakeholders do. This whole ESG piece is significant, and all of our organizations that we work with are looking at it with various degrees of speed and impact. So I think the ethics and greenwashing and this notion of whether the behaviors in the organization are matching purpose are the big issue, aren't they? Last week, you saw Legal & General making a statement saying that the businesses they invested in, they would look to the boards, and they would look to the board's behavior to see in one thing they've been working very hard on, being part of the 30% club and also the diversity project, that they had seen a 30% then increase in, or they were seeking 30% representation on boards of women. And they were moving now to say they expected to have a person of color on that board too. So they were starting to push their businesses they invested into and their stewardship notion into some direct action. And this weekend, Oliver Shah in the Sunday Times wrote his piece about whether he believed in this. And I think it's really important for us to look at this. And he talked about being a man with biracial parents and how he believed he'd gone to Cambridge. And by implication, I read it that actually that was a similar bubble, and that he looked at social mobility to be an instrument of real change. So I think everything that we look at in terms of purpose, and we look at some behaviors, and we look at some actions in it, there are always other actions that come out of it. There are always other debates around things. And organizations have to look in depth about these things and be prepared to change and be prepared to be held to account for some of those things when they look at it. Now, there are many examples of this, and probably in your course of your podcast, you may be just going to look at this as a topic. But the other small one in terms of action, I would say, is because I do think it's purposeful. IKEA this week deciding it's going to buy back the furniture that you had bought. What a great thing to do. So we've got massive sustainability issues. We've got great things about behaviors that accord with their market segment and will be really valued by them. And it's authentic. So I think there are lots of really exciting things happening. And we're involved in some different ways as well. And I think we should look to the best and see what we can do to learn from that.
How has BLM impacted your view of the world, our industry, and generally how we live our lives?
I mean, I've had to spend quite a time reflecting on it myself, and I have to for lots of reasons. I'm as we all are, a product of our time. My feminism is based on the time of which it was emerging and the battles I was fighting. And I had to look at myself and realize that my notion of being colorblind wasn't enough. And being a business that was meritocratic wasn't enough. And I think that has been a catalyst for so many things. So one is the cause of self-reflection. I'm lucky enough also to work with some great people at Lansons who are looking at this in detail, and we're collectively looking at what our diversity policy is. And if anyone looks on our website, we've declared what we're trying to do as a consequence. Source material is important. We work for, I mentioned, the diversity project with the asset management industry. I've been on the webinars there and been astonished by my ignorance and my lack of participation. I believe I can do things and make things happen, and I haven't done enough. And I see this. If I can find my own route through this, I know I can be an instrument of change and an advocate and an ally. And I think we have to look at that. Everything else is outside. We've got to look into ourselves to do it. We work with the New Writing Theatre Company at Lansons, and they are a business and an organisation that looks to other voices, and their head of artistic development is someone called Shubha Das, and Shubha is very involved in this and instantaneously talked about book lists and films and immersion and discussion, and that's been really important. So on the back of this, I think it will be and is a really important time. I recognize my white privilege, and I think we have to really look at the many things that we can all do in our lives. So we know, for example, it's our recruitment policy, our training policy. We're looking at the organizations that we work with to seek out those that are owned by or led by people of color. But I do believe I'm on a journey, to be honest. I didn't think I was discriminating, and I thought I was inclusive. And I'm recognizing now, together at Lansons, we want to make major strides, and we will. And we were involved in so many organizations like the BBC 50-50. We're a founding member of that, which is about equality of women and men, but also they're looking at this whole issue at the same time as well. So I feel we have some organizations we work with that are great. PRCA, as you know, is doing some great work here. Tony stepped down from the council because he felt that as another white male leader, he should do that. And Rimi Shah from Lansons has taken his place on the committee. So we feel that there are a range of things we can do, not in a piecemeal way. We have to have a plan and we have a process, but there's much to do. And I admire the people who are taking stands in this as well.
This is an incredible time, a time when things have to change in terms of the inequalities in society at large. And from there, we come into the industry, which has very low representation. And as you said, it's best to, you know, sort of reflect to see what are the things that, you know, we can do as organizations and as the industry to ensure that we're able to get the talent that already exists in the industry and also create a pipeline and get people to be interested in working in PR, because PR is not so diverse.
But also that there are, so for example, you know that we're part of two international groups. Our international groups have been meeting last week, and around the world, we represent the world. And so whilst the UK has a principally white industry for all sorts of things about lack of access and role models and all the things that we know about, it would be wrong to think that there aren't great businesses around the world led by people of colour and black people who are doing phenomenal work. And they need to come in as well. And we need to invite them in and work together, which we do on both the PROI worldwide group, and they have their APAC group now. And that is a vision of what the future should look like. And also the GCP group as well. So I think there are groups that are more representative, but we need to collaborate, partner, build together and be more encouraging and inclusive in our industry. We've got a long way to go, haven't we?
Absolutely. But we've started on the journey, and I think that's great because everybody wants to be a part of the change. And while it's not enough to say that we have started on the journey now, I think it's best to acknowledge that a good time to start if you've not, and move from there with people and experts. How relevant do you think, according to you, are PR and communications professionals in today's world, in this post-COVID world?
Well, it's so interesting, isn't it? This is, I mean, the industry is moving so quickly, isn't it? That whole debate is it PR? Is it communications? What is it that we do? But this was last week, wasn't it? The Tesla decided they were never a company that enjoyed having to speak to the media or be answerable to those people, but they've closed down apparently their PR team, redeployed some in different areas, and some have left the business. Trump likes to talk direct to his public. So we know there's a shift, isn't there, in the nature of what communications is and the job we do. And on the other side, when we were at our PROI conference and our GCP ones, we had discussions around this. And Arun Provoke spoke to GCP, and Tony interviewed him. And he said that he felt that both independent consultancies, which we are, have a phenomenal chance now because we can shape our destiny. So we can move quickly in the things that we believe in. But also importantly, corporate communications through COVID had really shown that it was on the top of everyone's agenda. that actually boardrooms recognize the significance of their brand, their reputation, their purpose. A reputation was vital for them in these times, and that, again, our role in business had never been greater. And I think that there was a great communications person who always said, you can't talk yourself out of something you've behaved yourself into. And with COVID, this notion of how you behaved in this period has shown a huge amount of virtue in some of those businesses, not all by any chance, but that we can make changes if we want to. And corporate communications is vital to do that. So I think it's an encouraging period now.
I really liked your point about independent agencies have a huge opportunity. I heard this at one of the webinars. What is required is agility and the ability to adapt and change quickly to meet the requirements of clients and be trusted advisors. And I guess independent agencies have a better chance of doing that than large, cumbersome organizations.
Because if you think about it, we are nimble. We're in charge of our own finances. We recognize the opportunity we have to. We are more entrepreneurial. Every day we're seeking opportunity. I don't mean that just in new business. I mean in shaping things, in moving on, in being brave, in pushing ahead on things. So we're constantly reinventing ourselves. Otherwise, we would die. And we can only survive on the last great piece of work we did. And it's got to come fast and furiously through organizations to make us relevant. So I think it's a great time for independence. It's a pressure, as it is on everybody, but it's a great chance for us.
So Lansons has been a winner of UK's top 25 best places to work for women. And also you report voluntarily and proactively on the gender pay gap. Is this by design? Is this because, you know, of the things that you set out to be when you started out?
I'm really pleased that this is now something that organizations talk about. It was always part of our intention. At the very beginning, as I said, I wanted no glass ceiling because I'd experienced it. There's never been any holding back of anyone that has talent at Lansons. And there are role models throughout the organization to show you can do it in different ways as well. And that's also, I think, really important that people can see themselves in the leadership and see different routes to that. We're an organization as well that takes people who are, you know, first or second jobbers, and we train people, give them scope, and they can go from being someone who comes in, even on something we should call the front of house, all the way through to being on the board. Obviously, it could take time, but nonetheless, it will be through there. So we have role models throughout the business. We have equity, as you know, because we're a partnership. So women own more of the business. They are almost always dominating any of our senior teams, and if not dominating, equal on those. We have always shown that we're great if people have caring responsibilities. We've always been supportive and found a way of working around and with the people who have caring duties. We have had shared parental leave, and we've got a massive track record of support for those people who share that together. So one is there's no gender pay gap. We promote people from within. They have an opportunity to shape their future careers. And that is a very empowering place to be for a woman. The Great Place to Work, in fact, for 16 years that we've been one of the top 50 places, I think also shows that we have to have exceptional men who believe in equality too. The men and women have to believe in this philosophy to be able to thrive and to enjoy it and to bring on the next generation all the way through to have the same opportunities or hopefully more than they've had. And on the gender pay gap, we believed in it as soon as actually it was suggested. And so for 3 years, we have voluntarily published because, as you know, you have to be 250 and above. Yeah. We are a partnership and we're also now 85 people. So we still publish. And we have always crawled all over our statistics. I think I've mentioned how we like going in for awards and we like benchmarking ourselves. So this should be no surprise that we look at this. And I know, for example, last year we had 5 people off on maternity leave, and all you'd need to do is get the date of the time you submit your gender pay gap report relative to their time off, relative to someone leaving and someone joining, and that can make slightly different statistics. But we look at them and we analyze them and we say, is this how we want our business to be? Is this right? Is it fair? What might we have to be aware of to bring it back? So, for example, about 40% of our recruits are from non-Russell Group universities. So we care about that diversity of different types of backgrounds. We've got a high percentage of disadvantaged backgrounds too. So within our statistics on gender pay, we also look at meritocracy too. And we found that there was a disparity for a little while in taking it too many people from Russell Group. You know, we were able then to take a look at that and say, hang on a moment, they're all brilliant candidates, but our philosophy is a broader intake. So we have to look to this and challenge ourselves more to get back into the framework that we wanted to have. So we believe statistics are good. They help remind you of your path, challenge you on the decisions you've made, and help you set some new courses ahead as well. And I think it is difficult because people will always say, I was one of the few that didn't work for, and that's fair enough. I'm sure we've got things wrong. But in the main, we've got them right, and hopefully others feel brave about doing this too.
This is what I get from your response on the gender pay gap. Actually, people cannot make excuses. If you can do it, the other guys can also do it.
Absolutely. You have to have an intention. We never had an intention to pay a man more than a woman. We never have. So we don't. But in the main, you know, because all of us, you know, have good times and bad times, and we are people with very long careers at Lansons as well as shorter. And we have to see the person in the whole. And how does it become a useful tool rather than just, you know, keeping these stats feel good about ourselves? That won't help change. We're a business that wants to get better each year, to improve each year, the quality of the work for our clients, the insight we offer them, the breadth, the challenges, and the impact we have on them, and the same in our organization. We want to get better each year. It won't be the same as everybody's, but for us, it matters as a community, as a collegiate, collaborative group. We want to get better each year, whether that's our footprint or whether that's our work. And there are always challenges, and that is fantastic to see some progress. And I think it's great for us to reflect on the brilliance in many organisations in our sector, bring back to us at Lansons the great things they're doing, and hopefully see if we can incorporate them.
I think that's the way to go. Moving on to the next question, what, according to you, is the role of ethics and PR, especially considering that Lansons won PRCA's first ever very large agency ethical champion in 2018, 2019, and 2020?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's a lot of debate on ethics and communications industries and agencies. And certainly we're a business that expects to make money. We are... you know, we touch on sectors that some people perhaps wouldn't want to. So our ethics come with a range of things. Many of the things we talked about today, we're 11 years as carbon neutral. We don't have a gender pay gap. We promote women. We're a meritocracy. We recruit from charities that are looking at social mobility. So the Social Mobility Foundation for years, LEAP. These are organizations in and around giving access to people who wouldn't ordinarily have access. So in one sense, it's the philosophy which we run our business. And on the other side, it's things like individuals can choose to say they don't want to work on some of our clients. So there may be reasons that they feel that doesn't accord with things they believe in. And so they might not be on those and they would work on others. I mean, obviously, they would have to feel comfortable working on our client base. But people have individual votes. We have an ethics committee. And as you know, this year, the PRCA, there are various themes. Obviously, Black Lives Matters, and their race initiative is terrific, and that's moving really quickly. And I'd just like to say a big plug for somebody I know on that. Anne-Marie is fantastic. But they're also looking at ethics. So how do we as an industry have some sort of collective vision of what that represents? And for us, we've had an ethics committee at Lansons who we run all our clients by. They never know the fee that we're being offered. And they will independently, they're not on the management board, and they come up with recommendations to us to help be our conscience. And I'm sure like other agencies, we very often turn things down for all sorts of different reasons. And I think we regard ourselves as being true to our purpose and our culture. And I think ethics is a difficult word because it can so easily mean different things to different people. But I am proud of the work that we do, and I'm proud of the thinking that goes into it and our broadness of approach. But again, I want to be out and about finding and picking up anything that's great out there and bringing it back to my own organization. And that, you know, I think that's good, isn't it? It's great to pick up amazing ideas and bring them back. We all know about the bad practices and we all know about those sorts of things. But when you're also a long-term business like us, 30 odd years of doing this, we know that we can shape our destiny, and we know that mistakes can ruin us because we are a reputation management consultancy. So we work very hard to think that we know that things might take a while to improve or to become part of our DNA, but they do become part of our DNA. And then you look back and realize there's been years worth of progress and years worth of demonstration of what that means. So I think a small pebble and the ripples it makes are worth making. So that drop, that move, that step is worth making. It's great if it's a giant stride, but anything that is good should be banked, held on, cherished, and then look for more.
Great thing to do. What are the three things you'd say we need to do to create a more inclusive industry?
Well, one is to listen, look for views outside our own, because even if we don't think we're in bubbles, we are. We always reinforce our own prejudices unintentionally, but we have to look wider and to be inclusive. I do believe in being a meritocratic business, and so inclusive and meritocratic, and we need role models in our industry, and we seek those role models with different voices to be the clarion call for us, so that we can all learn from each other's stories and vision and where they see the world. Strangely, Virginia Bottomley, it was her who said, when you recruit or you look at the people that you are working with, you don't look in a mirror, you look out of the window. And I think that it's never been a more important time now to look into society. They are the people we represent, and we have to understand everybody.
As a woman leader, Claire, what do you think that agencies need to do in order to adapt to the changing needs of clients, communities, and employees? We've seen that, you know, life in an agency or life for the client is very different to what it was 8 months back, 9 months back. As a woman leader, what would you suggest? What are these changes that are required? And the reason why I'm stressing on women leader is that research shows that women leaders in the world have responded better to the crises than other leaders.
Yes, you can see that leadership around the world, there's been some very notable women haven't come forward as well. So what I would say is we're in a really difficult period, aren't we? And there are many people suffering immeasurably, whether that be in our industry with layoffs, whether that is businesses that are struggling, whether that is through loss of people that they love, or whether it is the damage that the economy is facing now and will be going through for some period of time. So, you know, we've got to acknowledge that this is a very challenging period for people. We haven't spoken about mental health, and that is going to remain a significant issue, not just with the notion of working from home and isolation and the notion of us being social beings and needing to be very often in society. And in the other, it's seeing the scope in society to make changes and to recognize a sense of what the future can be. And as either business leaders or participants, the place that we have and the role we have to be part of that change. And I know it can at times sound like empty words, but I truly believe that we can be part of the future we want to make. And this is the time now to step up. And as an entrepreneur, I know I have the agency to make some changes. So I think broadly, we need to keep an open mind. Tony's just led a piece with the PRCA International Group with 70 different agency leaders talking about how they see COVID in the future. And there's enormous optimism. Arun in Provoke, if you speak to Francis at the PRCA, there is an optimism. And our industry is optimistic, and we can be party to some of the solutions if we put our minds to it, if we collaborate and we partner. I think there is immense opportunity and hope in us, and we can champion for change. And all I would say is, for example, in the agency today, I just flicked through, I'm working from home. We have something called Wellness Wednesdays, which we open the office for those who want to come in. And I noticed that we've been working with one of our clients, the Co-op Bank, with Refuge Charity, and it's about domestic abuse. And they've done a big campaign on no economic abuse and how we can look at that and support each other. And I think going back to the big picture and the small one, we can all make a difference, and we need to find the ways to make a difference.
You've answered it very well. And I think the things that I take away from this response is to reflect there is optimism, there is opportunity, and there is hope.
A fairer society is an equitable one that includes the rich and the poor, and the strong and the weak, and we have a chance to be part of that. So thank you for asking me questions.
You were brilliant, and I think everybody is going to enjoy listening to this.
That's really kind. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.